Go eat all with Tay and Gay.
Oh, that was refreshing. Oh. Oh, hi, didn't see you there. Welcome to Know It All with Tay and Gay. I'm Tay. And it looks like Kevin is still fast asleep. So I suppose I'll take this one. Last time we left you at Sleepy Valley Forge, things weren't looking good for America. It was hard. And just like the current political climate, Washington likely felt that we were just circling the drain. You know, if I might take this opportunity to say how I really feel about the state of our country.
Hey, Taylor.
Oh, hi, hey, Kevin.
What were you just talking about?
I was just introducing the new episode.
How long have I been asleep?
According to the recording equipment, 6 hours.
Good nap.
Yeah, good nap.
So last time we left you at Sleepy Valley Forge, things weren't looking good for America. It was hard.
Way ahead of you, buddy.
Oh, well, our fresh new military was no match for the British Army. Who could a fledgling nation to be turned to in its most desperate hour?
France.
That is literally the last thing I would have guessed.
It's a different time.
Apparently.
This was a job for John Adams, or it would have been if it weren't for this. Quote,
I have been tasked by General George Washington with a 6-week journey across the treacherous Atlantic Ocean to spend 2 months in France, of all places, in order to earn allegiance with them. Unfortunately, due to geography, this nation of cheese-eating fops is our best chance at independence. Is steeping so low as to ask these clowns for their cooperation really worth our independence? For me, the answer is unquestionably no. No, no, no. The Brotherhood is, however, larger than me, and the task must get done. Which is why, with a sly rearranging of the paperwork, John Jay has sent the impetuous Thomas Jefferson in my place to that dank purgatory. Franklin was more than ready to accompany Jefferson. All the best. I could definitely use a few months without him dictating everything I do and say.
Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin loved France.
And France loved them.
I've never seen young TJ so at home in all my days. His large, sometimes intrusive gesturing has truly found an audience amidst this nation of lovers of the craft of mime, which he has already begun to study and, frankly, innovate. I, on the other hand, have been gluttonously gorging on pistachio eclairs, Bordeaux's, and women. These people have developed such a rich culture of foods and wines that the rations of inebriates I brought from the colonies is blowing people's minds. Even tobacco. I mean, they can't get enough of it. Nor us, each night. Young Thomas has corralled a large group of people on the street corner with an impromptu performance, whom I further seduce through wit, music, and exotic substances. I, in all honesty, find no hyperbole in stating that to this nation, young TJ and I are a sexual force to be reckoned with. Last night, we happened to bed a few members of the French royal family. Unbeknownst to us, and afterwards for rather obvious reasons, they insisted on giving our nation assistance. Some guy from the Spanish royal family was there too, so we got Spain's alliance as well. Day 4 of our 2-month adventure finds our mission complete.
9 months later, France had the largest population surge in their history.
And about 15 years later, the French Revolution was raging on.
Interesting.
TJ and Franklin achieved their goal so quickly that they were surprised to find the war still raging when they returned to the colonies several months later.
From the April 16th meeting of the Brotherhood.
Well, this war seems to be taking much longer than any of us could have expected. Despite their frequent tactical blunders and almost suicidal formations, their army's dependence on monocles to see properly, and their 100% tea-based diet, the British have so many men at their disposal that we are literally running out of bullets.
Gentlemen, you all read their offer for total self-governance, yes? It strikes me as a totally fair deal, and I think we should at least consider it.
A silence fell on the room.
None of you read it, did you? Adams, you're a legal scholar, so surely—
It's so dry. I just fell asleep. Yeah, sorry.
So, gentlemen, it looks like we're in this for the long haul. No quick fixes, just good old-fashioned slaughter. Isn't that what you'd prefer, George?
Washington made a crude gesture at Franklin and gave his comb-over a tussle.
And then Arnold, who had been silent for a while, spoke up.
Arnold, you've been silent for a while. Speak up.
Well, the way I see it, number for number, we're so well. Are we agreed?
Yeah, totally, yeah.
So, let's think about this for a minute. Who has the talking ball? Just as I suspected. The talking ball. No one can talk unless they're holding it, and none of us have a clue where it is now. Where did you get the idea, George?
Primary school, I suppose. My instructor, Sir Jonathan...
Sir Jonathan. Proper Englishman, that. A stickler for rules, eh?
What Englishman isn't?
Yeah. They really like rules.
Yeah, they love rules. They love rules.
We don't care too much for rules, do we? We're hardly the type. No, like King George said, there's something of the American native in us now. We don't like rules, but some people live by them, and some people die by them.
So you want us to find, and if necessary, start using the talking ball again, is that it?
Yeah, let's get it. Let's get it. Why not?
Please just listen to me.
Hey, you don't have the talking ball.
Yeah, shut up, Benedict. Come on.
Hey, it's not your turn.
This is the talking boot. Whoever is wearing the talking boot gets to talk, and no one else does.
That's not fair. It's already laced on.
Listen to me! If I defect and gain a position of respect, I can rewrite their rules so that their soldiers are practically required to die. It's foolproof.
Defect?
They'll never believe you, Benedict. My God, you've taken 7 bullets for the cause. And you're a canon of satire!
Your accent, you sound like one of us.
Oh, do I, eh, Gov?
Incredible.
It takes a lot of courage to be a double agent. You even need to be willing to, once in a while, allow men on your own side to perish. This takes an unbreakable heart and an iron constitution, so we can't judge Benedict Arnold for the American lives he was required to take.
No, we should instead be celebrating the ways in which he led our foes to disaster.
English military tactics may have been useful against the French or the Spanish, but against us, scrappy Americans, they were considerably less effective. In fact, the average lobsterback was so concerned with keeping his uniform tidy that he wouldn't permit himself to kneel down or take cover if it meant soiling his breeches.
Benedict Arnold capitalized on this by ordering rigorous inspections of his unit's uniforms, always with a magnifying glass. Sometimes in the middle of battle, he would stroll through the firing line and remove random soldiers to inspect their boots.
If he couldn't see his face in them, he had that soldier executed for treason. His inspections were so intense that the British budget for soap and laundresses rose to 10% of the total war cost.
Check out this correspondence between King George and General Cornwallis, favorite son and favorite whipping boy of England's military blunders.
General, it has come to my attention that the regiments under command of Colonel Benedict Arnold, recent defector, have sustained considerable losses in the past 4 months. Rumor has it that this is due to his ruthless uniform inspection policy. My question to you is this. Why is it that you would place our soldiers in the field of battle without inspecting their uniforms beforehand? And why would you willfully place them in such a predicament that their uniforms, which are to me like the Union Jack itself, could accumulate such filth in the first place? Your next supply shipment will contain 6 checkered picnic blankets, 1 square kilometer each. I trust you will know what to do with them. Best, George.
With a genius like Arnold destroying their army from the inside out, it's no wonder the American Revolution made the 7 Years' War look like the 30 Years' War.
Oh,
oh
my God!
I know.
Oh!
I've wanted to say that for a while.
Huh. Okay, come on. Arnold was cautious at first, but after the English military had fallen for a number of his ploys without the slightest hint of suspicion, he began to get even more bold.
Dearest diary, I would say that the British lead themselves like lambs to the slaughter, but lambs are too organized. No, they are more like lemmings, dashing to oblivion a stupefied rabble at the insistence of God knows what impulse. Yesterday I literally told a man to shoot himself in the foot for the king, and he did. They are simply too deferent to authority. Last month, a spy, 1 rank lower than myself, burst in and declared that Washington had plans to cross the Delaware and ambush our Hessian allies. I simply said, "That's not true," and they all believed me. I told them about the talking ball, and it was immediately sent to King George. No one has said a word in the 2 months since the ball was sent to his throne room.
Arnold kept feeding Washington as much information as he was privy to, which, as a brigadier general, was considerable.
Dear George, Cornwallis frightened me yesterday. He actually had a good idea. Well, only for a moment. Our friend decided that an all-out naval assault on the Massachusetts Bay would turn the tide of the war in the Crown's favor, and this is entirely true. Do you know what I did? I told him that, unfortunately, the tide in Massachusetts was too low this year, and he'd have better luck performing his assault at Yorktown, which you and I both know is a superfluous dump. Around him? Yes? No? Maybe? Whatever you decide. Best, Benedict.
As a native Virginian, Washington's response was a resounding yes. He immediately began sending battle invitations to friends and family to, quote, join and or behold the undoing of the British this Saturday at the Battle of Yorktown, end quote.
But before we go there, let's hear a word from our sponsors.
Do you find that your paved driveway lacks character? Does your garden look sparse and unimaginative? Do you have a variety of charmingly shaped glass containers in your household, just begging to be filled? Well, fret no more. Gravel is here. With gravel, life gains a little more character, a lot more crunch, and that rich, jagged texture we've all come to know and love. Gravel comes in an infinite variety of shapes. Each rock as unique as a snowflake. Gravel is strong, so strong that even an automobile cannot crush it. Gravel is colorful, too, coming in hundreds of shades of gray, brown, and drab blue. Grab a handful of the good stuff. Gravel.
Arnold and Washington in tandem led Cornwallis and therefore the British army into a death trap which everyone understood would bring a definitive victory to the colonies and end to the war.
Washington understood this so well, in fact, that he began celebrating his victory before the first shots had even been fired, by shattering champagne bottles on cannons and taking consensus from his troops as to which flag design best represented the colonies.
Slightly presumptuous.
But just slightly.
Right. Washington had surrounded the British on 3 sides, with a river on the 4th. The Lobsterbacks were done for, and Cornwallis was smack dab in the middle of all of it. And up to this point, the British were completely unaware of the presence of any Continental soldiers.
September 28th, 1781. George Washington was overlooking the British encampment at Yorktown, smoking his pipe, drinking from his flask, sniffing from his snuffbox, and writing a letter accepting Cornwallis's surrender. But rather than sending it by messenger, George got to his feet, walked through the British lines, and straight into Cornwallis's quarters to read him the letter himself.
Dear Chuck, I'm sorry to hear about your current predicament, only I'm not in the least bit sorry. It seems that my troops have surrounded you on all sides and are gun crazy, and you, like a coward, have chosen surrender rather than meet an honorable fate at the end of my saber. However, after much consideration, I can't help but ask myself, who am I to stand in the way of a long, healthy, long life of failure, regret, and shame? I have decided to sheathe my sword and accept yours, which I will use to shish my kebabs. Now get your troops off this land, which we are still in the process of taking from these Redskins, and don't come back. Victoriously yours, George, winner, winner, chicken dinner, Washington.
Unfortunately, Ben Franklin was nowhere around, so Cornwallis's response is lost to history.
Washington returned to the camp the next morning, free of injury, looking well rested, his uniform cleaner than when he left, but his knuckles noticeably red. He refused to talk about what had occurred the night before, saying about it only,
"He said no."
That day, the Continental Army began a ruthless siege on the British at Yorktown that would last 3 weeks and ultimately lead to the British surrender.
Washington gave them a chance. He pretty much said straight to their faces, "Checkmate." Firing a gun at this point is merely a formality.
Like I said, though, the British love formalities. Their mortal downfall. October 19th, the day of the English surrender to the Americans at Yorktown.
Cornwallis had performed exceptionally poorly, disappointing his surviving troops, which were many, as well as his liege, King George III. King George was supposed to show up to grovel for mercy and kiss the boots of his enemy.
As was English tradition.
Washington and Franklin had spent all day dirtying up their boots for the occasion, and his absence was very disappointing.
I spent all day walking around in cow turds, and King George doesn't even have the decency to show up.
England is very far away, George. Do you really want to wait 2 months?
I've waited all my life for this moment. I can wait a little longer.
General Cornwallis is more than a suitable substitute. Look, he even has a cold sore. You can make him lick your boots, too. He has to ask for it.
Jeez, criminy, them and their traditions. When I'm king, I'll have one tradition. George Washington Day.
John Jay hadn't yet quite hammered out the details of the Articles of Confederation. So far, all he'd been able to do was give Hancock an entirely ceremonial position in the House of Delegates, which Hancock simply loved.
He just wanted the attention.
Washington assumed, like many, that we'd simply copy the English constitutional monarchy and be done with it. He also assumed that as the richest, largest, and strongest man in America, he would simply assume the position of king with minimal fuss.
Once the enemy's boots were licked clean, it was time for the losing side to offer the traditional shower of compliments upon the victor.
Oh, stop. It's not that big.
What a bunch of dandies. How did we lose more than a single man to these fops?
Speaking of which, George, where is Benedict?
George! Benjamin, I surrender.
Benedict? Why are you surrendering? Just come over here and look important with us.
No. See? We haven't signed anything yet. Mission's not over till we've minded our P's and Q's.
They're rubbing off on you, Benedict. Really, no one will care.
I care! You asked me to commit, I commit to the end. Now shove that boot in my face, George. I brushed my teeth for this.
Finally, the war was at an end, and it was time to begin the laborious and dull task of rebuilding a nation.
But we can't rebuild a nation, Taylor, without a word from our sponsors.
I've owned this house for 23 years. Each night I like to sit with my dog Scamp by the fireplace and read and admire my trophies. One day my friend Jim asked me why I never lit a fire in the fireplace. I did. I tried for years to keep that dang fireplace lit. I burned anything I could find. Trash, clothing, tires, paper. Everything either went out instantly or filled my home with toxic fumes. That's when Jim pointed me to firewood. Apparently the stuff that trees are made of is combustible, burns well for quite some time, and even has the ability to fill your home with delicious, all-natural smoke. Now, each night Scamp and I keep warm by a lit fire, which throws a living light over my trophies. I don't even need my pipe. When it comes to making a fire, I go with wood.
At war's end, the Articles of Confederation were technically in effect, but there were so many dark spots and loopholes that it essentially permitted a state of ponyless anarchy that would last until something better was written.
But they couldn't even begin until all of the paperwork from the war was completed, which would take John Jay another 3 years to do. Meanwhile, the other members of the Brotherhood went on a long and well-deserved vacation.
After another 3 rigorous years of Jay tracking everyone down, the Brotherhood reassembled for what was supposed to be a belated victory party. Instead, Washington famously pulled out his saber, barred the doors, and said,
"Until we write ourselves a constitution, no one leaves this room.
With no drugs, and only the ability to cultivate a low-grade prison wine from the materials in the room, the entire Continental Congress was forced into withdrawal. For 9 days, these grown men growled, cried, and vomited and tore at each other.
Even Washington himself withdrew, but he had such a strong constitution that in the ensuing slurry of rehabilitation, he never even so much as broke a sweat.
Most of the delegates were too deep into alcohol withdrawal to hold a quill, but Jefferson and Madison had rationed their flasks nicely.
9 days of shrieking! If I were literate, I'd write the damn thing myself, but none of you shivering freaks will teach me!
Jefferson, unkempt and stinking with sweat, crept up to Madison with puppy dog eyes and pantomimed a drinking gesture. Madison handed him his flask, and Jefferson killed the reserves in a single mighty pull.
Whatever happened to Sharon, TJ? Christ! We gotta get this done now! I can feel the shakes coming already! Jefferson, find me anything to write with. I don't care if I gotta paint hieroglyphs. This Constitution's getting writ now!
Jefferson scampered away and came back with the only writing tool in the building.
A tattoo needle? Oh, Christ! All right, kid. I hope you got a steady hand, because my back's the only part of my body without ink anymore. Navy life, you understand.
In a grueling 13-hour session, Jefferson took dictation and tattooed the entirety of the Constitution and Bill of Rights onto Madison's back in his trademark cursive.
All right, Tommy, you're gonna have to gussy up these sentences real nice, because I ain't good with words, you dig? All right, rule one. No one can tell you what to say, ever. You want to shout fire in a crowded theater? Fine, be my guest. All right, get to it before I gets too sweaty.
All of our rights as citizens were inscribed directly onto his back? Inspiring.
I know. We should get tattoos.
Of what?
Of Madison getting the Constitution tattooed on his back, of course.
10. No one gets to tell you what to do all the time. Nah, scratch that. Nah, that's no good. Let's face it. Sometimes you gotta stay in line. How about this? The government can tell you what to do, but only kind of, you know, just for the big stuff. The rest, you're on your own. Oh, and no slaves. Do we have any room for no slaves?
He didn't, and with that came a not-so-new kind of tyranny lasting another century.
Upon its completion, and well before its ratification, Washington swung open the doors and flooded the room with all the inebriates his spies could gather since the door was barred. And for the ensuing 19 days, the Founding Fathers threw a huge bash to celebrate all they had accomplished.
This is where we get the term political party, but even to this day, we've never had a political party quite like this.
Washington was unanimously declared winner of a belching contest on day 4 and was thus given the seat of first president.
Madison played his harpsichord for an audience for the first time in 16 years.
And in a drunken stupor, Alexander Hamilton bet against himself in a duel with Aaron Burr. He lost the duel, but won the bet, and though he had died, within 10 years, the Hamilton family had completely seized ownership of the Burr estate. So, Taylor, we've got the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the American Revolution. Is there anything else?
Nope. I think that's it. The Brotherhood disbanded as the party ended, and they all went their separate ways except Hamilton, because he was already dead.
Right. Washington served as first president of the United States of America, retired to his home in Mount Vernon with his wife Martha, and died standing in his bedroom looking out his window, keeping watch on his property. His skeleton still stands at that window today.
John Hancock was elected first president of Congress, and he never once showed up. For Hancock, the party never ended. He refused to believe that his best days were behind him, and for his final few years indulged in all of life's vices. That high was eventually matched by a low so bad that Hancock took his own life by strangling himself with a belt. He left a note, which said simply,
"This note would have been longer if my signature was smaller. John Hancock!"
John Jay worked tirelessly for 14 more years to complete all the paperwork. The evening he finished it, he got up from his desk, walked to his house, got in bed with his wife, and never woke up. His quill was still in his hand.
That's dedication.
John Jay was buried on the Jay estate in a coffin stuffed with paperwork. That's the way the remaining members of the Brotherhood thought he would have wanted it.
John Adams became the second president of the United States. He served one term, ultimately being bested by his nemesis, Thomas Jefferson, in an arm wrestling contest. Adams was so distraught by the loss, he didn't even show up to Jefferson's inauguration. Adams fell into a deep, dark depression for 45 years until the day of his death at the ripe old age of 91.
Thomas Jefferson became our nation's third president. He bought an enormous piece of our nation in the Louisiana Purchase from his friends, the French, for the price of $15 million and an exclusive two-week run of Jefferson's most recent one-man show, TJ Can Play, at Paris's Comédie Française.
A steal at half the price.
After surrendering his presidency to Madison, Jefferson continued to be involved in public affairs, but for all his political work, Jefferson's influence resonates most in the work of figures like Marcel Marceau, Hijikata Tatsumi, Moshe Feldenkrais, Charlie Chaplin, and most abundantly in the movement stylings of the late Michael Jackson.
James Madison literally fought his way into the presidency, knocking out fellow rivals with an undefeated bottle fight record. After that, Congress decided that from then on, the office of presidency would be voted on by the people, as Madison's rampage left dozens of dead politicians in its wake.
Madison was a master of outsmarting his human opponents, as he showed on a daily basis, his office littered with trophies taken from his numerous challengers' remains. On the final day of his term, though, a new opponent showed up to Madison's office. Boxcar Cornelius, the fighting kangaroo. Boxcar slew Madison in the fifth round, and for one day ruled over the United States. His kibble was poisoned that evening by our fifth president, James Monroe.
Benjamin Franklin continued his exploration of life's indulgences until he eventually found his substance of choice, lead. He loved the high he got from lead so much that he, of all people, began to use it exclusively.
This is about where his life's dictation stops.
We all know the poisonous effects of lead.
But he didn't.
Most leadheads quickly descend into madness, but Franklin was different. The lead is believed to have spiked his creativity. It was at this point that he invented the glass harmonica, megafocals, began work on oceanography and meteorology, and did his first experiments with electricity. Franklin's final years were messy. On his 89th birthday, Franklin ran naked into a storm, and his lead-addled body was, unsurprisingly, struck by lightning.
And then there was Benedict Arnold, probably the best actor in our nation's history.
Even today, more than two centuries after his death, he's considered a traitor. Riveting.
Arnold delved deeper into his character his entire life. He spent his post-war days living the life of a British ex-military leader. He helped form the Lobsterback Union, which was specifically designed to assist aging soldiers of the American Revolution.
He died of apparent delirium in 1801.
Fitting.
But this is where the brilliance of our founding fathers shines its brightest. Even after their demise, the system they constructed lives on.
The highest among us and the lowest, the smartest and the dumbest, the prettiest and the ugliest, the richest and the poorest, all of our lives are touched.
Some might say blessed.
By the grace of our founding fathers. America was built to last. But in these days of congressional gridlock and corrupt politicians, that strength can be tested. It is our duty to our founding fathers that we openly question our place in the world. And that's why I think it's vital that we ask ourselves if we truly live in the greatest country on earth.
No. We live in the greatest country in the galaxy. Kevin, do you think we live in the greatest country on earth?
No. I think we live in the greatest country in the universe.
You're right.
Taylor, if I can quote Walt Whitman from his poem Homage to America.
Please.
Land of the free, home of the brave, America, you're the country I would save. Were the English in some nightmare future to demand our assistance from an evil foe, I would have no choice but to go to their houses of parliament and take a dump on the flow.
Beautiful. Did our founding fathers ask for much of us? No. They simply asked that we live in harmony, and that no matter what party we dutifully vote for, no matter who we worship, no matter whether we own lots of land or only a small estate, that we do whatever it takes to ensure freedom for everyone, but first and foremost, for ourselves.
I'm almost crying, Taylor.
I'm always crying, Kevin.
I love America.
And America loves you.
Taylor?
Kevin?
I've got some special listener mail for you.
Oh, yeah? You're just diving right in?
I think
no anecdotes or
lead-ins? I think you'll see why in a minute.
Okay. Now,
dear Tay and K.
Hello.
As an avid listener of Tay and K since Candy, I feel compelled to tell you that your podcast is truly an inspiration to all citizens, young and old alike. Your patriotic zeal is undeniable, and your dedication to the dissemination of truth is commendable. Highly commendable. Therefore, it is with great pleasure that I award the two of you the Congressional Medal of Freedom. Wear it with pride. Your biggest fan, Barack Obama!
Whoa! Oh, Mr. President, I don't know what to say.
I know, right?
I mean, I'm so honored. Well, a medal's no trophy, but still.
And this may be my proudest moment.
Yeah, I know. It's all downhill from here.
Hey, hold your horses.
What?
There's only one medal in here.
What, is it some kind of mistake?
The way the letter is worded, it doesn't seem like it.
All right, you take it 1 week, I take it the other week.
Yeah, rock, paper, scissors for the first week?
No, it's Janessa's wedding this week. You should wear it instead of a tie or a groomsman.
Thanks.
And thank you for enduring the volumes of history. And thank you, Mr. President. We hope you enjoyed hearing it as much as we enjoyed telling it to you.
This has been Know It All with Tay and Kay. I'm Kay.
And I'm Tay. And join us next time when we talk about Wikipedia.
This week's episode of Know It All with Tay and Kay was brought to you by Bubbles.